the years. This, at last, was the shoe that fit Antonio. Living at a centre called Team Challenge, in idyllic green fields on the outskirts of Lisbon, surrounded by the quiet whir of wind farms, he learned for the first time how to trust. He was amazed that the people he meets leave him alone with their wallets or their children. He never thought that would happen to him again. Step by step, he was gaining the confidence to leave his drug use behind. When I met him, he had been abstinent for years. Now, every morning, Antonio goes out in a van to find the addicts on the streets who are still lost in their pain, to give them whatever they need, whether it's food or clean needles, or the knowledge that there is a safe place they can come to, for free, for love, when they are ready. He believes in giving out lots of hugs. All across the country, there are armies of former addicts employed like this, to rescue the people they left behind on the streets. And it was only when I met Antonio and saw his little white van that I thought I really began to understand what had happened in Portugal in the decades since the death of the drug war. Prohibition, this policy I have traced across continents and across a century, consists of endlessly spreading downward spirals. People get addicted, so we humiliate and shame them until they become more addicted. They then have to feed their habit by persuading more people to buy the drugs from them and become addicted in turn. Then those people need to be humiliated and shamed, and so it goes on and on. But in Portugal, after the drug war, the state helped people to get better, and then those people helped more people to get better. And then they helped still more people to get better, and so the downward spiral of the drug war has been replaced by a healing ripple that spreads slowly out across the society. On my last day in Lisbon, I thought of João as a young man on the streets of Lisbon, watching the tyranny fall. And I thought I could now see why he believes this is the continuation of the spirit of 1974. The Portuguese people rose up then to say that every single one of them deserved a life and a voice, and that they would not be beaten down or shut up ever again. And now their drug policy says that every one of them, even the weakest and sickest of their siblings, deserves not to be beaten down or shut up, but to be embraced and offered hope and love. In a true democracy, nobody gets written off. Nobody gets abandoned. Nobody's life is declared to be not worth living. That was the spirit of the revolution. The revolution lives. Chapter 17. The Man in the Well. When I started this book, no country had ever gone further than decriminalization. Portugal was the end of the line. But then, as I was writing, history began to shift beneath my feet. One country, a tiny nation sandwiched between Argentina and Brazil, took a step nobody had taken since Harry Anslinger's war began in the 1930s. They fully legalized a drug. And, at the same time, a rebellion began at the very heart of the drug war, when two American states, in ballot initiatives, voted to do the same. I was about to discover the answer to a question that had hung over me from the start. What happens when you legalize a drug? I booked my flights, and I discovered that the president who stands at the end of the drug war has a story far stranger than I could have imagined. I interviewed his wife, his closest friends, his biographer, his critics, his chief of staff, and finally him. This is what I learned from them. José Mujica looked up at the light. It seemed that the roof of the long, damp well where he'd been kept prisoner for 2.5 years was covered with only a flimsy sheet of aluminum. If he could reach it, if he could stretch, he could, surely, push it aside, and he would be free. He would be back in the world at last. He was as emaciated as a concentration camp prisoner by now, and he stank from drinking his own piss. It taught me to talk to the person that we all have inside, he told me years later. Since I couldn't talk to the world, I tried to stay alive by calling on the world I had inside myself. He would pick up one of the many bugs crawling all around him, hold it to his ear, and then, inside the tremendous silence, he would hear the insect shouting to him very loudly. He had also made friends with the frogs. When he was thrown water by the guards, he would try to share a little with them. Those were the only non-aggressive live beings I had surrounding me in those days, he would explain to another interviewer later. But Muhika did not let the insects and frogs shout their messages to him for long, because he was afraid for them. The government, he believed, had planted a secret listening device in his ear to hear everything he could hear and to read his thoughts. He knew this was true because he had a burning sensation in his ear, and because the people who would do this to him could, he was convinced, do anything. Perhaps it was for the best that Muhika didn't know that the metal at the top of the well couldn't be pushed away, by him or by anyone. It was part of a tank. The dictators who had seized power in Uruguay were not taking any chances. They wanted him sealed away from the world. The only thing worse than solitude, he tells me softly, is death. As he and his friends were being sealed into separate wells, the guards told them, "You guys are being held as hostages. If anybody on the outside does anything crazy, we'll kill you. We'll kill you." Jose Mujica had grown up not far from this prison in Montevideo. It was one of those neighborhoods where the countryside bleeds into the city, and half-built slums form the scar tissue in between. As a boy, he had watched the farm fields, just beyond the city, wither and empty out, one by one. The farmers who had worked those fields were streaming hungrily into the town to try to hustle a living. Mujica's father lost everything, and died when the boy was just 7. His mother grew flowers, and the young Mujica was sent out to sell them. It was only because they all worked constantly that they did not starve. By the time Mujica got to the university, the country's economy had gone into a deep depression. Kids with distended stomachs toddled around the slums, wasting away, and the political mood began to darken. Some of the worst of the Nazi war criminals, including Joseph Mengele, were living in the country with the tacit approval of the regime. Then, one day, a senior general in the Uruguayan military revealed that the army was planning a military coup. Mujica and his friends believed they couldn't just sit back and watch, so they formed a group called the Tupamaros and started to hijack food trucks destined for wealthy areas, driving them to poor neighborhoods and giving all the contents away. They went to the sugarcane workers and gave them arms so they could take over their fields themselves. They began to seize control of whole cities, and they quickly became known as the Robin Hood guerrillas. They chose to name a woman as the honorary leader, Miss Marple, the elderly spinster who solves crimes in Agatha Christie's novels. She represented for them the principle of justice, and that, they said, is what we were fighting for. Like the French Resistance, the Tupamaros were organized into different pillars, all operating separately, so that if one pillar was captured, the movement would live on. Jose and his wife Lucia belonged to pillar number 10. They lived underground and spent their time being bundled from one safe house to the next, planning operations, until one day, as Mujica was waiting to meet a contact in a bar, suddenly something hit him in the chest. The police shot him 6 times. But they didn't let him die. They needed him as a hostage, to discipline his comrades. Mujica does not talk about the torture he endured while in prison, but some of the other survivors from that time told me about what happened to them. The guards were fond of the submarine, where you hold a man's head underwater until he is about to drown, and then suddenly yank him out. They also applied electric shocks to men's cheeks, nipples, and testicles. From his well, Mujica was only allowed to write to Lucia, his wife, once. She was being held in prison, too. She was also being tortured. "If we ever get out of this," he told her, "we are going to get a little plot of land somewhere, a farm, and make it ours." There must have been days when it seemed that this would never end, that this would be his reality forever. In a well nearby, one of his comrades had died, although Mujica didn't know it yet, and wouldn't for years. And then, one day, alone, Jose Mujica heard a human voice. Then there were lots of voices. It was a chant. "Your struggle is our struggle," the voices said. "Your struggle is our struggle. We are here. We believe in what you're doing. We are here. We believe in what you're doing." This time, it was not a hallucination. It was the beginning of the end of the dictatorship. Mujica kept the promise to Lucia that he had scribbled in the silence of the well. They bought a tiny shack on the outskirts of the city with an iron roof and a little stretch of farmland, and there they planted flowers, like the ones his mother had grown in his childhood, long ago. One night in November 2005, Jose Mujica and his wife returned to this shack to find it looking a little different. All their neighbors were there, cheering and singing, and there were barbecues all around them, where everyone was cooking their best meat and offering it around in jubilation. Mujica had just been elected president of Uruguay. He announced that he would not be moving into the presidential palace. He would be staying right here, in his shack, for his full 5-year term. He would be giving 90% of his income to the poor and living on $775 a month. And as for the presidential limousine, no thanks. He would take the bus. In Uruguay, the president is sworn in on Inauguration Day by the most popularly elected senator. That senator was Lucia. He introduced a law providing a laptop for every child in Uruguay, and he legalized same-sex marriage and abortion. But there was another issue waiting for him. His cabinet had been watching the news from northern Mexico as it was cannibalized by cartels. Uruguay similarly sits on the transit route for marijuana and cocaine being transported to Europe. The cartels already have a role in controlling Paraguay, the country next door. If the cartels chose to seize Uruguay, they realized, the country would be defenseless. Mujica would have liberated his nation for nothing. So he began to look at the history of drug policy and realized, he told me, that we have for over 100 years been following the policy of repressing drugs, and after 100 years we have realized that it has been a resounding failure. We have to try other ways. The defense secretary, Eleuterio Ueodobro, is another survivor of the well. He told me he saw now that the United States drug war causes more harm than marijuana itself. Many more deaths. Much more destabilization. This is worse for the world in general than any drug. The remedy is worse than the illness. It's a war that's lost already. You're not going to win it. It's totally lost. You're not going to win it ever. But what is the alternative? It was explained to them that when you legalize drugs, you bankrupt most of the cartels. Government regulation can provide a product that is cheaper, higher quality, and not sold in dark alleyways. The drug dealers would go the way of alcohol-selling gangsters into the dustbin of history. Mujica decided he would start with marijuana on the assumption that over time other drugs would follow, until they were all regulated. Previously, presidents across the world had held back from legalization because of two fears. The first was of the United States. The second was of their own people. But President Mujica, from his shack, was noticing a crucial shift. In the United States, several states were poised to vote to fully legalize marijuana, to allow it to be grown and sold to adults, as we'll see later. And he resolved to persuade his people to do likewise. In solitary confinement, he tells me, he had learned that life is a fine thing. So, above and beyond everything, we have to defend life. We shouldn't sacrifice a generation in the name of a dream. To figure out how to make legalization work, he turned to two men from the land of his old honorary leader, Miss Marple. Britain. Many people will begin to travel some way down the road leading away from the drug war, but then they smack into a concrete wall. Written on that wall is the word legalization. And next to the L word, there is a mural of a man named Timothy Leary. He was the most famous face of 1960s drug legalization, a Harvard professor who dropped out to preach that everybody should take drugs and sail away on the trip that would finally bring Western civilization crashing down. His eyes flashing, Leary evangelized on a cascade of TV shows that he was the founder of a new religion, with cannabis and LSD as its sacraments. These drugs should, he said, be given to 12-year-olds, so they can fuck righteously and without guilt. And to prove the point, he gave them to his own young teenage children, even as they went slowly insane. "Please, wake up!" Leary's daughter wrote to him in letters while he swallowed more tabs than Pac-Man. "You are destructive and evil." She later dissolved into insanity and committed suicide. Leary had already told his friends, "You know, I really am a psychopath." At first, Leary had argued that drugs made you blissed out and pacifist. Then he argued that his followers should shoot policemen because total war is upon us. When he ended up on the run in Algeria, he told the Islamic fundamentalists there that they should like him, because he had screwed up the brains of so many American middle-class white people. By the end of his life, he was arguing we should all live in space, because I've always been an enemy of gravity. Leary was the most credentialed salesman of legalization the American people had seen since Henry Smith Williams. Today, many people still believe that legalization would be an expression of his values, that drug use is a good thing and should be encouraged, that it would make drugs available to children, that legalization would lead to much more widespread drug use, and that it would end with the destruction of our culture as we know it. But the people Mujica sought out make the case for legalization for precisely the opposite reasons. They want to legalize drugs because they want to get them out of the hands of our kids, defend the basic values of law and order, and reduce anarchy and violence. They don't want a world where drug use becomes more exciting and revolutionary. They want a world where it becomes much more boring. They are a pair of English policy wonks called Danny Kushlick and Steve Rolls. Danny had been working for years with prisoners on probation, and he was sick of watching his clients die of overdoses. Steve was a scientist investigating the effects of ecstasy, who stood with a clipboard taking notes at raves, and noticed that people on ecstasy were much more friendly and less violent than the alcohol drinkers he was used to. "It was startling," he says, "to see the police round them up and take them off to the cells." Together, Danny and Steve formed a group called the Transform Drugs Policy Institute, to answer a question nobody else in the world was answering in any detail. In practice, on your street, what does legalization mean? If we end the drug war, how will drugs be distributed? Who will be allowed to use them? What would change? I have been discussing these issues with Danny and Steve for nearly 10 years now, and they have become my friends. As they began their investigations, Danny and Steve knew that most people believed legalizing drugs would mean there would be a crack and meth aisle in every branch of CVS, between the candy bars and the flavored water. Legalization, its opponents believe, means a free-for-all. But as they looked at the evidence, Danny and Steve came to believe that it would mean the opposite. Today, the trade in drugs consists of unknown gangsters selling unknown chemicals to unknown users in the dark. That is the definition of a free-for-all. The only way to regulate this trade, they believe, is to turn on the lights. And the first thing they discovered is that to legalize drugs, you don't have to invent anything new. The structures already exist all around us. At the moment, we have a licensed and regulated way to sell the two deadliest recreational drugs on Earth, alcohol and tobacco. This wasn't always the case. For a time, various governments experimented with suppressing them by force. In the 17th century, Tsar Michael Fyodorovich of Russia decreed that anyone caught with tobacco should be tortured until he gave up the name of the supplier. Around the same time, Sultan Murad IV of the Ottoman Empire introduced the death penalty for smoking. In both countries, people still smoked. So, we set up a system where adults can buy this drug legally, but at the same time we make it clear, as a culture, that it makes you sick. You can't do it in most public places, and most of us find the habit unpleasant. As a result of this policy, where tobacco is legal but increasingly socially disapproved of, cigarette smoking has fallen dramatically. In 1960, in the United States, according to the General Household Survey, 59% of men and 43% of women were smokers. Today it's 26% of men and 23% of women. A halving. There have been similar trends across the developed world. Just because something harmful is legal doesn't mean people rush to use it. More and more are turning away from it. So Danny and Steve concluded that we need to divide drugs into at least two different tiers, depending on how powerful they are. In the first tier, you find the less potent drugs, like marijuana. For them, their solution is, treat it like tobacco and booze. That would mean, in Europe at least, no advertising, no promotions, sell them in plain packages with no logos, but lots of health warnings through licensed vendors. Impose strict age restrictions. Sell them in dull, designated stores. If anyone uses drugs in public, while driving, at work, or while performing any responsible task that requires concentration, severely punish them. If they sell them to kids, strip them of their licenses. In other words, expand the web of regulation covering booze and cigarettes to cover them. At the next tier, you find the more potent drugs, such as heroin. Again, Danny and Steve say, we already have a form of regulation suitable for them. Across every country in the developed world, there is a network of doctors and pharmacists who prescribe powerful chemicals on the basis of your doctor's assessment of whether you need them. As you read this, they are handing out opiates and amphetamines and everything in between for medical purposes. This, too, can be expanded, just as they've done in Switzerland. Under this model, addicts would be prescribed their drug by their doctor, while being offered all sorts of programs to help them stop using. Expanding these two tiers of regulation that already exist would, they argue, end most of the problems caused by the drug war today. It would mean people who go right now to armed gangsters on street corners will go either to licensed stores or to doctors and pharmacists for their drugs. This isn't a vision in which we lose control of drugs, Danny and Steve argue. It's a vision in which we gain control, at last. Legalization is the only way of introducing regulation to the drug market. If this were done, the people selling drugs wouldn't be shooting each other any more than your local neighborhood barkeeps sent hitmen to slaughter each other. The users would know what they were taking. And through taxation, we would have a huge new revenue stream to educate kids and invest in reducing the real causes of addiction. We have run this historical experiment once before, they point out, and we know what one of the effects will be. When alcohol was legalized again in 1933, the involvement of gangsters and murderers and killing in the alcohol trade virtually ended. Peace was restored to the streets of Chicago. The murder rate fell dramatically, and it didn't rise so high again until drug prohibition was intensified in the 1970s and 80s. At its heart, legalization is, Danny tells me, a drama reduction program, because all the excitement, the salaciousness, the sexiness of drugs is very much in their prohibition, not their regulation. Somebody once said to me, what you really need to do is get a movie made of what legalization would look like. And I said, Jesus, that would be the most boring film in the world. Because it would be. It's going to be watching somebody walk into a shop and say, please can I have some MDMA? And they will say, yes, here's some, that'll be £4.50, please. There's a real danger, as we move toward the end of the war and the beginning of the new system, that we continue to associate the horrors and the excitement of prohibition with a new regime that is, actually, incredibly boring. The culture of terror will turn, slowly but ineluctably, into a culture of tedium. But what happens next? I had seen clearly that prohibition doesn't work, and Portugal shows that decriminalization is a significant advance. But what about legalization? The difference is simple. When you decriminalize, you stop punishing drug users and drug addicts, but you continue to ban the manufacture and selling of the drugs. They are still supplied by criminal drug dealers. When you legalize, you set up a network of stores or pharmacies where users and addicts can buy their drugs. One crucial question hangs over this vision, one that understandably stops many people from buying this whole argument. If we make drugs more easily available, won't more people use them? And a whole range of concerns follows from that. There are, for me, three in particular. If more people use them, won't more people become addicted? Won't more people overdose? And won't more kids get hold of drugs? If you're thinking of moving beyond decriminalization into legalization, these are the central questions that have to be answered. To determine whether drug use would increase, I started to go through the evidence carefully, and I soon found that it is mixed. There are two important pieces of proof from the past, the quasi-legalization of marijuana in the Netherlands and the end of alcohol prohibition in the United States. They offer different lessons. In 1976, the Dutch introduced a new drug policy. They announced if you had up to 30 grams of marijuana on you, the police wouldn't take it away. This is, in effect, decriminalization of personal use. All legal punishments for cannabis use among adults ended. What happens next? According to all the available evidence, over the next 7 years, levels of drug use remained the same. Then the Netherlands took another step, which was to allow cannabis to be sold openly in licensed cafes. This was a move from the decriminalization of personal possession to, effectively, the legalization of selling the drug itself. They backed away from calling it legalization because that would breach the UN treaties authored by Harry Anslinger. But it is, for all intents and purposes, a very modest form of legalization. And the results, it turns out, were equally clear. There was an increase in the use of the drug. Among the people most likely to smoke weed, 18 to 20-year-olds, The proportion of people who had used cannabis in the previous month rose from 8.5% to 18.5%. For other age groups, there was a smaller but still real rise. This increase did not happen in other European cities at that time, so it's reasonable to assume that it was a result of this policy. Some of this increase was probably due to the fact that people are more likely to openly admit to smoking cannabis when it's no longer a crime, but it's unlikely that this explains all of the rise. This finding suggests that there is no significant increase in drug use if a country decriminalizes possession, but some increase when they legalize sale. The reason seems to be pretty obvious. It's about ease of access. We all, I think, know people who would not approach a street dealer for a drug in an alleyway, but who might buy it if it were sold in a store or pharmacy in the local shopping mall. It's important to be candid about this rise, but also important not to exaggerate its scale. Cannabis use rose a little, but it's still low in the Netherlands. Some 5% of Dutch citizens reported smoking cannabis in the previous month, which is lower than the United States at 6.3% and the EU average of 7%. Cannabis consumption didn't spiral out of control, and it remains low compared to other countries. But there's a significant complicating factor to this rise, one explained to me by Danny. Try, as you read this, to see drug use as an overall number. Everyone in the world tonight who is taking a drug counts as one drug user. You'd include everyone buying a joint or taking an ecstasy pill, but should you include every pint of beer and every shot of whiskey in that tally? If you don't count alcohol as drug use, then drug use would go up. But if you do count alcohol as drug use, then there is some evidence suggesting overall drug use will not go up after legalization. Why? What seems to happen when you legalize marijuana is that a significant number of people looking to chill out transfer from getting drunk to getting stoned. After California made it much easier to get marijuana from your doctor, anyone claiming a bad back was given a permit, traffic accidents fell by 8%. Because lots of people made this shift, and driving when you're stoned, while a bad idea, is nowhere near as dangerous as driving drunk. That's why Danny believes that talk about a rise in drug use is the wrong way of thinking about it. The more interesting question, he says, is how patterns of drug use will change. If we legalize ecstasy, and lots of people transferred from getting drunk on a Saturday night to taking ecstasy on a Saturday night, that would count in the official statistics as an increase in drug use. In fact, he says, it would be an improvement. Our streets would be less violent. Domestic violence would fall. Fewer people would get liver diseases. This is a more complex calculation, he says, than can be measured on a narrowly statistical balance sheet. I understand Danny's point, and I respect it, and I want it to be right, but I don't think it tells the whole picture. Here's an inconvenient fact for those of us who favor reform. There is strong evidence that during alcohol prohibition, fewer people drank, and after it ended, more people drank. It's hard to tell precisely, because measuring an illegal activity is always tough, but you can look at rates of cirrhosis of the liver, which corresponds with heavy alcohol use, and get a fairly good sense. Drinking seems to have fallen by between 10 and 20% during prohibition, and after it ceased, there was a very slow rise back over several decades. They weren't transferring to other intoxicants. There wasn't anything else. They were staying sober. In substantial numbers. It wasn't just a fall in drinking, either. It was a fall in alcoholism. Why? The best explanation is that there are significant numbers of people who want to obey the law because it is the law. If something is illegal, that has a deterrent effect all on its own. Then, on top of that, if you ban something, it does become somewhat harder for most people to get hold of it. I have complained in this book that the people who support the drug war sometimes use propaganda to promote their cause, so it's important that I resist the temptation to produce propaganda of my own. Those of us who have come to believe we should end the drug war have to be candid. The evidence suggests there will probably be a modest but real increase in use. Some significant share of that will be people transferring from alcohol, but probably not all of it. It should be acknowledged, one of the successes of prohibition, that it probably does hold down drug use somewhat. I have been trying for more than a year now to absorb what this fact means. When I discussed it with Danny one afternoon in the cafe at the British Library, he pointed out that most of us don't object to drug use in and of itself. We worry about the harms caused by drug use. If I told you that your neighbour smoked a spliff or snorted a line of coke last weekend, I doubt you would be deeply concerned. But you would, rightly, be worried if she was a teenager, or if she became an addict, or if she overdosed. It's not drug use that worries us, but the harms caused by drug use. And the evidence about these harms is quite striking. Legalization slightly increases drug use, but it significantly reduces drug harms. Let's start with teenagers. In the best available study, a large number of American teens in surveys explained that they found it easier to buy marijuana today than to buy beer or cigarettes. When I first read this, I found it puzzling. I only really understood why, one afternoon on my travels, when I was told about a road to Damascus that ran through a parking lot in New Jersey. This story was told to me in the winter of 2012, when I went to Trenton, New Jersey, a concrete wilderness town that bears an uncanny resemblance to the Gaza Strip. In an office overlooking the wheezing city, Fred Martins told me a story about his past. One day, in the early 1970s, he had been waiting in the lot outside a shopping mall to buy marijuana, PCP, heroin, and meth, and then bust the dealer's ass. This was the era of Dirty Harry, and Fred was an undercover cop who could easily have been Clint Eastwood's character, packing a magnum and a sneer. "I had no qualms," he told me, "about putting a gun in an informer's mouth and telling him, 'If you're fucking lying to me, I'll blow your fucking brains out. Do you get it?'" But something was about to happen that would make Fred rethink his support for the drug war. A kid approached him. He seemed to be about 12 years old. Mister, he said, "do me a favor. Could you buy me a bottle of wine in the liquor store?" Fred kicked him in the ass and snapped, "Get out of here!" He went back to waiting for a drug dealer so he could make his buy and make his bust. "But that's when the realization hit me," he told me. "I'm saying to myself, this kid needs me to get him a bottle of liquor, when he can go and get any drug he wants in the parking lot without me. What was better regulated, the liquor or the drugs in this parking lot?" It was an epiphany. What is this all about? The insight stayed with him as a source of doubt for years, and it made him come out in the end for legalization. Nobody in my nephew's schools, it occurred to me, as Fred talked, is selling Budweiser or Jack Daniels. But there are plenty of people selling weed and pills. Why? Because the people who sell alcohol in our culture have a really strong incentive not to sell to teenagers. If they do, they lose their license and their business. The people who sell other prohibited drugs in our culture have a really strong incentive to sell to teenagers. They are customers, like everyone else. If we legalize, there will be a barrier standing between our kids and drugs that does not exist today. This isn't theoretical. The societies that have tried this have shown it to be the case. Some 21% of Dutch teenagers have tried marijuana. In the United States, it is 45%. I picture my nephews and my niece. If I decide to support legalization, it won't be despite them. It will be because of them. Addiction seems more worrying. It is common sense that if more people use drugs, more people will become addicted to drugs. During alcohol prohibition, fewer people drank, and fewer people died of alcoholism and the diseases it causes. This weighs really heavily on me. If more people ended up like the people I love, the people who set me on this journey, desperate and broken, that would be a major reason not to change the existing policy. But then I contrast this evidence with the evidence from Portugal. More people used drugs, yet addiction fell substantially. Why? Because punishment, shaming a person, caging them, making them unemployable, traps them in addiction. Taking that money and spending it instead on helping them to get jobs and homes and decent lives makes it possible for many of them to stop. At the end of alcohol prohibition, they didn't use the massive new tax revenues to invest in educating kids about alcohol and turning the lives of alcoholics around. Portugal showed us there is another way. But what about overdose? This surely is the hardest point to answer. If more people use drugs, more will end up accidentally taking fatal doses. It seems obvious. But in fact, as I saw in Vancouver and Geneva, the places that have expanded legal access to hard drugs have seen an enormous fall in overdoses. Why? There are two big reasons. The first is that, at the moment, if you buy a drug from a gangster, you have no idea what is in it. Imagine ordering generic alcohol from the bar, not knowing whether it is an Alcopop or absinthe. You'd be far more likely to drink too much and collapse. In a regulated store, by contrast, you know what you are getting. The second reason is the iron law of prohibition, which I explained earlier. When you ban a drug, it's very risky to transport it, so dealers will always choose the drug that packs the strongest possible kick into the smallest possible space. That means that under prohibition, you can only get the most hardcore form of a drug. Beer disappeared during alcohol prohibition, and moonshine shone. As soon as alcohol prohibition ended, moonshine vanished. After drug prohibition, it's reasonable to expect that the milder forms of drugs that were popular before prohibition will come back, just as beer did. So the rise in drug use will most likely consist not of an army of crack addicts, but of an increase in people drinking stronger tea and smoking weaker spliffs. Nobody has ever overdosed on coca tea. I can feel, as I write this, that I am persuading myself that the full legal regulation of all drugs is a good idea. But then a set of prickly questions comes into my mind, and they won't go away. What about the most powerfully intoxicating drugs? Would you let people buy meth? Would you let people buy crack? When it comes to a drug like crack or meth, what does legalization even mean? Are we suggesting openly selling it? If not, would doctors even be willing to prescribe it? I keep putting this question to legalizers across the world. Their first response is usually to sigh and point out that those drugs make up 5% or less of the market for illegal drugs. So let's start, they say, with the other 95%. Take the politically possible steps today. We'll get to this conversation years from now, when it is no longer totally hypothetical. But this, it seems to me, is to dodge the question. So when you push further and ask the question again, you find that legalizers fall into three broad camps on these drugs. Some would leave a few drugs banned, as tiny islands of prohibition in a sea of regulation. They are aware that this would mean that small networks of drug gangs would persist, but there would be far fewer of them, because now they'd be meeting only a really small niche market for the most hardcore users. At the opposite end of the spectrum, you find some pure libertarians. They say, "You have a right to damage your own body. It's your choice. If you're allowed to ski, or box, or race at 300 miles per hour on a private track, you should be allowed to ingest whatever chemicals you want. The job of government is not to protect you from yourself. If people want to buy crack, let them buy crack. Sell it along with the other drugs, in regulated stores." In between these two positions, there is a middle way. Build a third tier of regulation beyond open sale or prescription. You'd establish safe, designated rooms in our big cities where people would be allowed to buy and use these more hardcore drugs, with doctors on hand, provided they didn't leave until the drugs had worn off. It'd be like the safe injection rooms I saw in Vancouver and Switzerland, but with a broader range of drugs on offer, and tighter rules. The argument for this is that the hardcore users are going to take their drugs anyway. At least this way, they do it in a place where they can be kept away from everyone else, and where there are people to care for them, and patiently point the way toward getting help. But I remained nervous, nonetheless, about expanding legal access to these drugs for an obvious reason. One I had known since I was a child. Crack and meth contain such powerful chemical hooks that almost everyone who tries them will become addicted. I had learned this, without ever looking at the evidence. When I was shown the actual facts by real experts, I was startled. As an experiment, I'd like to quickly test how well you know this. Can you stop for a moment and write in the margin of this book what proportion of crack users you think become addicts? Don't read on until you've written down your estimate. In April 2012, the brilliant drug reformer Ethan Nadelman appeared on the MSNBC discussion show Hardball. The host, Chris Matthews, was clearly initially persuaded by Ethan's case for change, but then he backed off. He explained his worry. 10 people could have a glass of wine, and maybe 1 in 10 or 1 in 100 would become quickly addicted to alcohol. But I'm told, if you try crack cocaine once, you're liable to be addicted. This is what I believe, too. But then I interviewed Dr. Carl Hart, one of the world's leading experts on this question, at his offices in Columbia University, and what he showed me was so surprising I had to keep going back to see him repeatedly over the course of a year before I really accepted what he was saying. He talked me through the best scientific evidence, which he later expanded on in his book, High Price. He showed me that the evidence is that, of the people who have tried crack, just 3% have used it in the past month, and at most 20% were ever addicted at any point in their lives. Look again at the figure you wrote down. Is the real figure higher or lower than your guess? My initial estimate would have been 90%. I was wrong by 70%. Now I know that instead of the vast majority of users becoming addicted, as I and Chris Matthews thought, the vast majority of users, even of these substances, do not become addicted. When Rob Ford, the mayor of Toronto, was revealed to have used crack, and a month later the head of a major bank in Britain was caught buying meth, there was general bemusement. This wasn't our picture of a crack or meth user. People with responsible jobs, who appear to have functioned for quite a long time. Clearly, we thought, they were freakish exceptions. But in fact, according to the best available data, they are actually more typical users of the drug than Marcia Powell or Chyna's mom, Deborah. This feels strange to say. It seems intuitively wrong to me. But it is what the facts show. Why is this so surprising to all of us, me included? It took me a while to puzzle it out, but I think this is the reason. We still think, as I discussed earlier, of addiction as mainly caused by chemical hooks. There's something in the drug that, after a while, your body starts to crave and need. That's what we think addiction is. But chemical hooks are only a minor part of addiction. The other factors, like isolation and trauma, have been proven to be much bigger indicators. Yet, the drug war increases the biggest drivers of addiction, isolation and trauma, in order to protect potential users from a more minor driver of addiction, the chemical hook. If we legalize, somewhat more people will be exposed to the chemical hook in drugs, but the even larger drivers of addiction, trauma and isolation, will be dramatically reduced. As I try to understand this, I keep picturing the women back in Tent City on their chain gang. Imagine if, instead, you use that money, Portugal-style, to put them in a lovely clinic, teach them how to cope with pain, and help them get a job. Now imagine that kind of transformation spreading across a society, even one in which more people use drugs. Would addiction go up or down? How, in the end, can you decide whether you support drug legalization, and for which drugs? I can't decide that for you. It comes down to what you, personally, value more. What I did was draw up a balance sheet, and try to figure what I personally value more. I urge you to draw up your own balance sheet. Here's mine. In the column arguing against legalization, I wrote that drug use will probably go up. It won't be massive. We know that from both of the historical precedents. But it will be real. Some people today refuse to take drugs because it is a crime to do it, and because they fear either getting arrested or buying from criminals in alleyways. The day after legalization, this reason for reservation will no longer be there. That is a significant drawback. I searched very hard for other arguments to put in this column. I couldn't find any, but you may have some. Please, email them to me. In the column next to it, arguing for legalization, I found myself writing out the following arguments. Across the world, armed criminal gangs selling drugs will be financially crippled, from the Crips to the Zetas. The survivors will be pushed into much less profitable markets, where they will be able to do much less harm. As a result, the culture of terror that currently dominates whole neighborhoods and countries, from Brownsville, Brooklyn to Ciudad Juarez, will gradually abate. This happened after the end of alcohol prohibition. The murder rate will significantly fall. This also happened after the end of alcohol prohibition. Enormous amounts of police time will be freed up to investigate other crimes. Trust in the police will begin to come back to poor communities. This happened in Portugal. Teenagers will find it harder to get drugs. This happened in the Netherlands. Overdoses will significantly decline, and the rate of HIV transmission will fall dramatically. Both happened in Switzerland, the Netherlands, and Vancouver. The drugs people use will, in the main, be milder than today. Remember the Iron Law and the end of alcohol prohibition. There will be a lot more money to spend on treating addicts and dealing with the underlying causes of addiction. Many addicts who currently get worse behind bars will get better in hospitals, and then in new jobs. This means addiction will fall. This happened in Portugal. Millions of people who are currently imprisoned for non-violent offences at great expense to the taxpayers and to their communities, will walk free. Huge numbers of African-American and Latino men who are currently locked out of the workforce, student loans and public housing, will be allowed back in. Shaming addicts will be replaced by caring for addicts. Once I had drawn up my list, I compared the pros and cons of each side. Your calculation of benefits may well vary from drug to drug. Mine did. But when it comes to marijuana and the party drugs like ecstasy, up to and including cocaine, I think the harm caused by a small increase in use is plainly outweighed by all these gains. That's why I would sell them in regulated stores, like alcohol. And with drugs like crack and meth, I'm inclined to the middle option. Allow safe, regulated spaces where users can buy and take them, supervised by doctors. I can't support a policy that sacrifices people like Chino Hardin and Marsha Powell and Marisela Escobedo in order to prevent people who want to use drugs from taking them. I don't want to live in that world. When Danny and Steve arrived in Uruguay, they showed President Mujica how to begin to build this better path. Their blueprint, along with the advice offered by other drug reform groups, showed Mujica how to set up a legal, regulated framework for selling marijuana. After all the controversy, the proposals were pretty straightforward. In 2014, a legal structure was set up to let pharmacies across Uruguay sell marijuana to people over the age of 21 who produced a valid ID. The crop will be grown legally across the country and taxed. Each home is also allowed to grow a small number of marijuana plants for personal use. Nobody will ever be imprisoned for using this naturally growing plant again. Adults will be free to choose marijuana or alcohol on a Saturday night without any risk of punishment. Maybe, Mujica tells me, this policy will fail. But what we are doing now, under prohibition, is a failure every day. It is hard to see, he says, how the new policy could fail worse. Seen in the long sweep of human history, Danny says, it's not this new wave of legalization of drugs that is radical. The radical move, he tells me, was prohibition. The experiment that lasted a century and was based on the idea that it could eradicate entire plant species from the face of the earth and stop humans from getting high. When Danny launched Transform in the mid-1990s, he named 2020 as the year he believed would mark the end of the global drug war. He always said presidents would be coming to his door, asking how to do it. People laughed. They're not laughing now. On the sunlit winter's day, when I visit the presidential shack, the first thing I noticed is President Mujica's underwear flapping in the wind on a clothesline. His wife, Lucia, is standing by the door. There is not, she explains, much to see. It is, indeed, a shack, with a rather rickety-looking iron roof. There are three rooms, a tiny bedroom, a tiny kitchen, and a narrow living space that connects them with some books, a small wood fire, and a painting that was given to them by Evo Morales, the Bolivian president. That's it. The tour of the Uruguayan equivalent to the White House takes all of 90 seconds. It occurs to me that my own Prime Minister, David Cameron, would not keep his shoes here. Mujica would be different if he weren't kept prisoner, Lucia tells me. Because he had so much time to think, it became clear to him what was important in life. He learned to live with light baggage in jail. He learned that happiness doesn't come from what you have, but from what you are. Later, when I speak to him on the telephone, Mujica tells me, if I have too much luggage, too much property, too many material goods, that makes me worry I have to defend this stuff. Then, in that case, I will not have time left to take care of the things I really love. And then I lose my freedom. He is in a philosophical mood. "I am 78 years old," he says. "I had a dream of changing the history of man.